It's Friday, July 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Greece submits economic reform proposals. South Carolina removes the Confederate flag from its capital.
I'm very happy about it and think it's a good step forward.
And Egyptian-born actor Omar Sharif dies in Cairo. We'll look back at his remarkable career. It's all ahead. The Greek Parliament is meeting Friday to decide whether to endorse reforms proposed to European finance ministers in exchange for more bailout money. Greece is reportedly promising to cut spending and raise taxes in the latest proposal. Reporter Henry Ridgewell in London has just returned from Athens, and he spoke with me about the crisis. What is this latest proposal that Greek officials have submitted?
Well, many analysts say it doesn't differ much from the proposals that were suggested by the European Union to Greece more than a week ago, and the same proposals that were rejected by the Greek people in a referendum on Sunday. And that really poses the difficulty for Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, in that he's put the proposals to the Greek Parliament today. The Greek lawmakers will vote on them. Most people seem to expect that they will be approved, although many in the Greek media and many Greek politicians have picked up on the fact that these proposals are remarkably similar to what was put to the Greek people and was rejected to the Greek people. And indeed, some of the spending cuts that are detailed in the proposals go even further than the $9 billion that was suggested in the original plan. There are suggestions that the new spending cuts amount to around $12 billion. So whether Alexis Tsipras has the democratic mandate really to take these proposals to Brussels on Sunday and debate them with European leaders remains a little uncertain. And if an agreement is made at the weekend, which might relieve Greece's immediate economic crisis, there's no guarantee that when he returns back home on Monday, that the people will accept what he has done over the weekend. So although there is optimism today over the Greek suggestions that were submitted yesterday, there is optimism that a deal will be done. Markets have risen. Greece's borrowing costs have fallen slightly. There is still a lot of uncertainty and a lot of hurdles to be overcome.
Well, looking ahead to the meeting over the weekend, if this is approved and how European Union leaders will look at this, is it known, I know this is a bit speculative, that they will accept this?
There has been good noises, if you like, coming from Brussels, coming from especially Paris. The Parisian, the French finance minister, saying this was a serious and credible offer by Greece. A bit more muted response so far from Berlin, from Germany, which is, of course, the key nation, if you like, the hawk in these negotiations, which has demanded more cuts from Greece. They have said all along that they won't accept any so-called haircut on Greece's debt, i.e. a levelling down of the total amount they need or an extension of the period over which they must repay their debts. But today, with the proposal submitted, with the Greek Parliament due to vote on this, there is optimism among many EU officials that some kind of deal can be reached. Even Jerome Dijsselbloem, the head of the EU negotiations on this, has said that he thinks the Greek proposals are credible and that discussions will be had this weekend, which could lead to a deal. So we are further on from where we were a few days ago when there were major fears of an imminent Greek exit from the euro. There are still negotiations to be had and possibly sticking points over whether or not Greece's debt will be restructured. And that's a key one because that's a key demand of the Greek government. It's also a recommendation of the International Monetary Fund as well, but it's something that Berlin all along has said it won't accept. So we do need to see one side giving ground, and we're not sure which side that will be yet.
Henry, you're just back from Athens. How are people coping, you know, consumers, people and pensioners dealing with the situation there?
With difficulty, because cash withdrawals from ATM machines are limited to 60 euros a day, which in a society that still uses cash for quite a few transactions is proving problematic. And so many people are not spending on the things that they normally would when they could get free access to their savings, which, of course, is having a knock-on effect on the real economy, if you like. When people aren't spending on items that they would normally spend on, it's going to have a big effect. And, of course, this all plays into the bigger argument over the long-term recovery of Greece's economy, because if it's going to repay its debts at some point, it's going to have to see growth in the economy. But if it keeps on having these setbacks, for example, of the last 2 weeks of capital controls, of course, GDP is not going to grow and they're not going to be able to pay anything back. On the street, there is really a lot of fear still over whether the country is going to leave the euro. But it's really a fear of the unknown, because this is really a bit unprecedented. Of course, countries have gone bankrupt before, Argentina, for example, in the 1990s, but not a major developed country within a monetary union such as the euro. So anything that happens over the next week that might see Greece ejected from the euro could have major effects on the streets. Already, analysts say Greece's banking system is on the brink of collapse because the banks are almost out of money. And that is really the key barrier that means a deal has to be done in the coming days. Because if no deal is forthcoming, the European Central Bank won't give any more euros to Greece's banks. They will be out of money. And effectively, then the banks would have to be nationalized and taken over. And that would precipitate Greece's exit from the euro. So we've really got days over the next 4 or 5 days, we really will discover Greece's fate.
Thanks so much. That's Henry Ridgewell in London. In other news, an honor guard from the South Carolina Highway Patrol has taken down the Confederate flag that has flown on the grounds of the state capitol for more than 50 years. A biracial crowd of hundreds cheered and chanted USA, USA Friday as they witnessed the flag's historic removal from the statehouse grounds. The move comes 3 weeks after the racially inspired murders of 9 African-American church members in Charleston, South Carolina. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with Dr. Elsie Scott, the director of Howard University's Ron Walters Center.
South Carolina lawmakers have decided to take down the Confederate flag from state property. Dr. Scott, how does that hit you?
Well, first I say hallelujah. Secondly, I say it's about time. But I'm very happy about it and think it's a good step forward.
When we look at the Confederate flag, it's more than just a flag that represented a country that existed for 4 years and ended in 1865. There's a cultural and social subtext to this. Could you please explain that for VOA?
Growing up in the South, the Confederate flag to us meant hatred, racism. When people wanted to let you know that they hated you, they waved the flag in your face. When they wanted to discriminate against you, they put the flag up in their business. So it definitely has that meaning of not anything related to Civil War. You know, even those of us who grew up way after the Civil War, it was a symbol in the 60s of Jim Crow.
We saw in Charleston, South Carolina, just a short time ago, a terrible incident in which a young racist killed 9 people at an African-American church. There's been an awful lot of crying and healing since then. But with this flag, what can be healed? When can we put this thing away? When can we move forward? What's your perspective?
I'm a member of the AME Church, and I think we have the perspective that this is the first step. We are happy that the state of South Carolina has done what it has done. We're hoping that the other states will follow suit. But also, let's get to talking about how we got to where we are in terms of the racial divide, especially in the South. So we want to start by talking, and then we want to continue with action.
What does it take to reach across this divide? Is it possible for white Southerners and black Southerners to sit in the same place and shake hands? What does it take to cross this bridge?
I think it has already taken the death of 9 people, 9 innocent people in a church. And if that does not bring us to the table, I don't know what can. I hear the voice of Reverend Pinckney crying out from the grave, do something. And that's where, you know, I think a lot of my friends and my fellow members in the AME Church, that's what we feel like. He's guiding us to do more, and we're hoping that the white citizens will hear him.
Dr. Elsie Scott is at Howard University's Ron Walters Center.
And that's Jeffrey Young. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palchevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, you heard Dr. Scott use in that report, she said, it's about time. And that's the quote that we are seeing again and again on social media, people weighing in and saying it's about time that this flag comes down. The other social media trending story that's come out of South Carolina is from State Representative Jenny Horn. She took to the floor of the South Carolina State House the other night and was fighting back tears, saying, I'm a descendant of Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, and I think this flag should come down. It's a disgrace that this flag is up here. That video has gone viral. And she's since weighed out on social media. She tweeted out, she said, it wasn't easy. It wasn't without emotion, but I'm so proud of my colleagues for doing the right thing. The Confederate flag is coming down. So that's another trending story out of this, something she has become a name now associated with the story ever since this video has come out and spread throughout the internet. Another story we're seeing trending is Go Set a Watchman. Now, it's a title of a book by Harper Lee. Harper Lee wrote To Kill a Mockingbird over 50 years ago and has not written another novel since. Well, she's actually written a novel before To Kill a Mockingbird called Go Set a Watchman. The publisher said, well, we don't want to release this novel, write different ones. So she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, sold over 30 million copies worldwide, a huge success. And now she's releasing the second book, Go Kill a Watchman. And what's interesting is that the first chapter of that book was published online today in the Guardian newspaper in the UK and the Wall Street Journal here in the US. So people sharing that on social media, weighing in, saying, I can't wait for the book to come out on July 14th. They're saying it's reportedly the most pre-ordered book since the Harry Potter series. And that was, of course, a huge success
as well.
That's
saying something, yeah.
Yes, so for sure this is going to be a huge release. But that's a trending topic this morning as people are starting to read that book and anticipating its release on Tuesday. And finally, we have the championships at Wimbledon. Going on this weekend. You're going to see some names trending on social media for sure. And you're going to see a name this weekend, tomorrow. You're going to see Serena Williams, of course, the 20-time Grand Slam champion, but a name that you might not notice, Garbine Muguruza. She is 23 years old, and she's making her first appearance in a Grand Slam final from Spain. It's sure to be a good matchup. She actually beat Serena back in the French Open 2 years ago, so we'll see who prevails in that contest.
Very exciting. Thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palchevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of scientists say that they recently found proof that there are a number of hidden supermassive black holes in the universe. Using NASA's Nuclear Spectroscopic Telescope Array, or NuSTAR, satellite observatory, the researchers detected high-energy X-rays from five supermassive black holes that had been blocked from direct view by dust and gas. The astronomers say that their findings back a theory that suggests the existence of possibly millions of these supermassive black holes throughout the universe that are hidden from view. The five previously hidden black holes also appear to be much brighter and more active than had been previously thought. The researchers admit that without the NuSTAR satellite observatory, it would have been nearly impossible to make the observations that uncovered the supermassive black holes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a famed Egyptian actor dies in Cairo. The U.S. women's national soccer team was honored with a ticker tape parade through New York's Canyon of Heroes in celebration of their 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup. International Edition's Adam Phillips was in the crowd in Manhattan.
The mood just couldn't be happier here on Lower Broadway, also called the Canyon of Heroes, as the ticker tape parade honors the women's U.S. soccer team for clinching its third World Cup title. People have got flags, children are face painted, there are policemen out in force, they look super happy. And even when you look up at the sky, it's a beautiful sapphire blue filled with streamers and ticker tape. And I'm curious to see why this woman is here. She's especially colorful with her face paint and even her soccer tattoos.
I'm excited because the United States women's team won the World Cup. They've been competing for years. They've been working on this goal for 12 years, and they made it. The team is better than ever. A lot of young players, new players, old players, they work hard. and they dominated, and there's nothing better than that.
You psyched?
Very psyched. It just, there's not enough respect out there for women players. And I hope, you know, this will finally open everyone's eyes and give them the respect they deserve.
This is the first time a women's team has been honored with a ticker tape parade at the Canyon of Heroes, although Carol Heiss-Jenkins, an Olympic skater, was honored with the ticker tape parade back in 1960 when she won her gold. That's the scene here on Lower Broadway in the Canyon of Heroes. I'm delighted I was here for this historic event. Back to you, Sarah.
That's Adam Phillips in New York. Sounds like they're having a great time there. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition, and that's the theme from the 1962 film Lawrence of Arabia. One of its stars, Egyptian-born actor Omar Sharif, died Friday in a Cairo hospital, according to his longtime agent. The 83-year-old actor had been suffering from Alzheimer's disease. Sharif rose to international fame in the 1960s with leading roles in two epic movies, Lawrence of Arabia, as we heard, and Dr. Zhivago. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy interviewed him in Washington in September 2009. Mohammed, what did Omar Sharif tell you about his first encounter with the U.S. movie industry?
Sarah, Omar Sharif considered himself very lucky to launch his successful career, while it was very tough then for him to come from a country ruled by a charismatic leader that was perceived as anti-Western president.
I arrived in Hollywood when Nasser was in power. And Nasser at that time in the 60s was viewed in America just as badly as Saddam Hussein before they took him out anyway. And so it was, if you can imagine that an Iraqi actor before the Iraq War would come and become a star in Hollywood, you couldn't conceive it. Now this was a very lucky thing because I was lucky to find the right part in a great film. Lawrence of Arabia was a great film, probably one of the greatest films ever made. And so I was very lucky, and I was immediately nominated for an Academy Award.
However, Sarah, Omar Sharif told me that during the 4 years in the 1960s when he lived and worked here in the United States, he felt no tensions compared to what he called a widening gap between the United States and the Arab world.
The world was different. It was not like today where we have this terrible hatred between each other, between some of the Arabs and some of the Americans, those, you know, extreme radicals. So it was a different world. It's not the same world anymore.
The Egyptian international movie star was then under the impression that Americans over time struggled to distinguish between the small groups of Muslims who are hostile to the West and the vast majority who Omar Sharif said are peace-loving people.
We are very kind people. There are some people who are not. There are some crazy people. They were created by the Afghan war against Russia. What happened when they were armed with wonderful weapons, Stinger missiles and all, to get the Russians out of Afghanistan? A lot of Muslims went to fight and get the infidels out of Afghanistan, who were the Russians at that time. And when the war ended, they found themselves with no jobs. They didn't know what to do with themselves anymore. All they knew was how to fight, how to shoot Stinger missiles, how to shoot machine guns.
Omar Sharif has often sought roles that show how Muslims can live in harmony with people of other faith. An example to that, Sarah, in the 2003 French movie Monsieur Ibrahim, Omar Sharif played an elderly Muslim Turk who owns a little grocery shop in Paris and befriends a young Jewish boy. Omar Sharif advocated building bridges between different cultures, and he has a unique way of doing that through dialogue.
We must get rid of the hatred. We must be reasonable, all of us, them, the Americans, and us. We have to be reasonable and not have hatred at all. Have comprehension, try to arrange things, sit down and talk and be reasonable.
That's the late actor Omar Sharif, who died today in Cairo, Egypt. And Mohammed Elshenawy, thanks very much for bringing us those memories. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. You can see a range of stories on many issues. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations has declared a humanitarian situation in war-torn Yemen a level 3 emergency, the highest designation possible. According to the United Nations, more than 21.1 million people, over 80% of Yemen's population, are in need of aid, with 13 million facing food shortages and scarcity of other goods like fuel. Fuel and commercially imported food and medicine have been impacted severely by maritime interdiction operations, leading to scarcity of many resources. There are also reports of outbreaks of dengue fever and malaria that have already affected thousands of Yemenis. In addition, more than 3,000 people have been killed in the fighting. The military conflict in Yemen began in March when the Houthis took over large swaths of territory and forced the elected president, Abed Mansour Hadi, to flee the country. At the request of President Hadi, a Saudi Arabian-led military coalition began airstrikes against Houthi positions. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and UN Special Envoy to Yemen Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed have been urging a humanitarian pause between the parties during the holy month of Ramadan, which ends on July 17th, so urgently needed aid can reach the Yemeni people. A previous five-day pause in May was repeatedly violated by the Houthis. The United States joins the United Nations and the international community in calling for an immediate humanitarian pause. In a written statement, State Department spokesperson John Kirby noted, "A pause, along with commensurate disengagement of armed forces in all areas, including Aden, Taiz, and Marib, would allow international aid organizations to deliver urgently needed food, medicine, and fuel to citizens throughout Yemen. It would also allow for the delivery of vital commercial goods on which Yemen depends." The United States, said spokesperson Kirby, will continue to work actively with humanitarian organizations to help facilitate the unimpeded delivery of humanitarian aid.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.